stupid! Chains cried, leaping up with a glee that brought wet-sounding pops from his kneecaps. He waved his manacled hands like a bird trying to take flight. Carlo! Galdo! Get these damned things off my wrists so we can count our daily blessings! The two hooded boys hurried over and did something to the manacles that Locke couldn't quite follow. They slid open and fell to the floor with a jarring clatter. Chains gingerly rubbed the skin that had been beneath them. It was as white as the meat of a fresh fish.
"You're not really a priest,"
Locke added, while the older man caressed some colour back into his forearms. "Oh, no," Chains said. "I am a priest, just not a priest of, Perelandro. Nor are my initiates initiates of Perelandro, nor will you be an initiate of Perelandro. Loch Lamora, say hello to Carlo and Galdo Sansa." The white-robed boys swept back their hoods, and Locke saw that they were twins, perhaps a year or two older than himself, and far sturdier-looking. They had the olive skin and black hair of the true Camorri. Their identical, long, hook-ended noses, however, were something of an anomaly. Smiling, they joined hands and bowed in unison from the waist.
Hi, Locke said. Which of you is which?
Today I am Galdo, said the one on Locke's left. Tomorrow I will probably be Galdo, said the other one.
Or perhaps we'll both want to be Carlo,
added the one who had first spoken.
In time, Father Chains interrupted, you'll learn to tell them apart by the number of dents I've kicked in their respective asses. One of them always manages to be ahead of the other somehow.
He stood behind Locke and placed both of his wide, heavy hands on Locke's shoulders.
Idiots, this is Locke Lamora. As you can see, I've just bought him from your old benefactor, the Master of Shades Hill.
We remember you, said presumed Galdo.
A catchfire orphan, said presumed Carlo.
Father Chains bought us just after you arrived,
they said in unison, grinning.
Knock that bullshit off,
Father Chains said, his voice somehow regal.
You two have just volunteered to cook dinner. Pears and sausage in oil, and a double portion for your new little brother. Get! Locke and I will deal with the kettle.
Sneering and gesturing rudely as they went, the twins ran for the curtained door and vanished behind it. Locke could hear their footsteps trailing away down some sort of staircase. Then Father Chains motioned for him to sit beside the copper money kettle.
Sit, boy. Let's have a few words about what's going on here.
Chains eased himself back down to the damp floor, crossing his legs and settling a thoughtful stare on Locke.
Your former masters said you could do simple sums. Is this true?
Yes, master.
Don't call me master. Makes my balls shrivel and my teeth crack. Just call me Father Chains. And while you're sitting there, let's see you tip that kettle and count all the money in there.
Locke strained to pull the kettle over on one side, seeing now why Carlo and Galdo preferred to share the burden. Chains gave the kettle a push on the base, and its contents finally spilled out on the floor beside Locke.
"Makes it much harder to snatch, having it weigh that much,"
Chains said.
How can you pretend to be a priest?"
Locke asked, while he sorted full copper coins and clipped copper bits into little piles.
"Don't you fear the gods, the wrath of Perelandro?"
"Of course I do,"
Chains replied, running his fingers through his round, ragged beard.
"I fear them very much. Like I said, I'm a priest, just not a priest of Perelandro. I'm an initiated servant of the Nameless 13th, the Thief Watcher, the Crooked Warden, the Benefactor, Father of Necessary Pretexts."
But There are only the 12.
It's funny just how many people are sadly misinformed on that point, my dear boy. Imagine, if you will, that the 12 happen to have something of a black sheep younger brother, whose exclusive dominion happens to be thieves like you and I. Though the 12 won't allow his name to be spoken or heard, they have some lingering affection for his merry brand of fuckery. Thus, crooked old posers such as myself aren't blasted with lightning or pecked apart by crows for squatting in the temple of a more respectable god like Perelandro.
You're a priest of this 13th?
Indeed. A priest of thieves and a thieving priest, as Carlo and Galdo will be some day, and as you might be, provided you're worth even the pittance I paid for you.
But...
Locke reached out and plucked the thief-maker's purse, a pouch of rust-red leather, from the piles of copper and passed it to Chains.
If you paid for me, why did my old master leave an offering?
Ah... Rest assured that I did pay for you, and you were cheap, and this is no offering.
Chains untied the little pouch and let its contents, a single white shark's tooth as long as Locke's thumb, drop into his hand. Chains waved it at the boy.
Have you ever seen one of these before?
No. What is it?
It's a death mark. The tooth of the wolf shark is the personal sigil of Kappa Barsavi, your former master's boss. My boss and your boss, for that matter. It means that you're such a sullen, thick-skulled little fuck-up that your former master actually went to the Kappa and got permission to kill you.
Chains grinned, as though he were imparting nothing more than a ribald joke. Locke shivered.
Does that give you a moment of pause, my boy? Good. Stare at this thing, Locke. Take a good hard look. It means your death is paid for. I bought this from your former master when I got you at a bargain price. It means that if Duke Nicovante himself adopted you tomorrow and proclaimed you his heir, I could still crack your skull open and nail you to a post, and nobody in the city would lift a fucking finger.
Chains deftly shoved the tooth back into the red pouch, then hung it around Locke's neck by its slender cord.
"You're going to wear that," the older man said, "until I deem you worthy to remove it, or until I make use of the power it gives me, and so."
He slashed two fingers across the air in front of Locke's throat.
"Hide it under your clothes, and keep it next to your skin at all times, to remind you just how close, how very close, you came to getting your throat slit tonight." If your former master were one shade less greedy than he is vindictive, I don't doubt you'd be floating in the bay.
What did I do?
Chains did something with his eyes that made Locke feel smaller just for having tried to protest. Locke squirmed and fiddled with the deathmark pouch.
Please, boy, let's not start out with either of us insulting the other's intelligence. There are only three people in life you can never fool, pawnbrokers, whores, and your mother. Since your mother's dead, I've taken her place. Hence, I'm bullshit proof.
Chain's voice grew serious.
You know perfectly well why your former master would have cause to be displeased with you.
He said I wasn't circumspect.
Circumspect? Chains repeated. That's a good word. And no, you're not. He told me everything.
Locke looked up from his little piles of coins, his eyes wide and near watering.
Everything?
Quite everything.
Chains stared the boy down for a long, difficult moment, then sighed.
So what did the good citizens of Camorra give to the cause of Perelandro today?
27 copper barons, I think.
Just over 4 silver solons, then. A slow day.
but it beats every other form of theft I ever met.
You steal this money from Perelandro, too?
Of course I do, boy. I mentioned that I was a thief, didn't I? But not the sort of thief you're used to. Better. The entire city of Camor is full of idiots running around and getting hung, all because they think that stealing is something you do with your hands.
Father Chains spat.
What do you steal with, Father Chains?
The bearded priest tapped two fingers against the side of his head, then grinned widely. Brains and a big mouth, my boy. Brains and a big mouth. I planted my ass here 13 years ago, and the pious suckers of Camor have been feeding me coins ever since. Plus, I'm famous from Embelane to Tal Varar, which is pleasant, though mostly I like the cold coinage.
Isn't it uncomfortable?
Locke asked, looking around at the sad innards of the temple.
Living here, never going out?
Chains chuckled. This shabby little backstage is no more the full extent of my temple than your old home was really a graveyard. We're a different sort of thief here, Lamora. Deception and misdirection are our tools. We don't believe in hard work when a false face and a good line of bullshit can do so much more.
Then you're like teasers.
Perhaps, in the sense that a barrel of fire oil is akin to a pinch of red pepper. And that's why I paid for you, my boy, though you lack the good sense the gods gave a carrot. You lie like a floor tapestry. You're more crooked than an acrobat's spine. I could really make something of you if I decided I could trust you. His searching eyes rested once more on Locke, and the boy guessed that he was supposed to say something.
"I'd like that," he whispered. "What do I do?"
"You can start by talking. I want to hear about what you did at Shades Hill, the shit you pulled to get your former master angry at you."
"But you said you already knew everything."
"I do, but I want to hear it from you, plain and clear. And I want it right the first time, with no backtracking or parts left out. If you try to conceal anything that I know you should be mentioning, I'll have no choice but to consider you a worthless waste of my trust. And you're already wearing my response around your neck."
"Then where," said Locke, with only a slight catch in his voice, "do I start?"
"We can begin with your most recent transgressions. There's one law that the brothers and sisters of Shades Hill must never break. But your former master told me that you broke it twice and thought you were clever enough to get away with it."
Locke's cheeks turned bright red, and he stared down at his fingers.
"Tell me, Locke. The thief-maker said you arranged the murders of two other Shades Hill boys, and that he didn't pick up on your involvement until the second was already done."
Chains steepled his fingers before his face and gazed calmly at the boy with the death mark around his neck.
"I want to know why you killed them, and I want to know how you killed them, and I want to hear it from your own lips right now."
Part 1. Ambition. Why, I can smile and murder whiles I smile, and cry content to that which grieves my heart, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears, and frame my face to all occasions. King Henry VI, Part 3. Chapter 1. The Don Salvara Game. 1. Locke Lamora's rule of thumb was this. A good confidence game took 3 months to plan, 3 weeks to rehearse, and 3 seconds to win or lose the victim's trust forever. This time around, he planned to spend those 3 seconds getting strangled. Locke was on his knees, and Carlo, standing behind him, had a hemp rope coiled 3 times around his neck. The rough stuff looked impressive, and it would leave Locke's throat a very credible shade of red.
No genuine Camorri assassin old enough to waddle in a straight line would garrote with anything but silk or wire, of course, the better to crease the victim's windpipe. Yet if Don Lorenzo Salvara could tell a fake strangling from the real thing in the blink of an eye at 30 paces, they'd badly misjudge the man they planned to rob, and the whole game would be shot anyway.
"Can you see him yet? Or bug signal?"
Locke hissed his question as lightly as he could, then made a few impressive gurgling sounds.
"No signal. No Don Salvara. Can you breathe?" "Fine, just fine," Locke whispered. "But shake me some more. That's the convincer."
They were in the dead-end alley beside the old temple of Fortunate Waters. The temple's prayer waterfalls could be heard gushing somewhere behind the high plaster wall. Locke clutched once again at the harmless coils of rope circling his neck, and spared a glance for the horse staring at him from just a few paces away, laden down with a rich-looking cargo of merchants' packs. The poor dumb animal was gentled. There was neither curiosity nor fear behind the milk-white shells of its unblinking eyes. It wouldn't have cared even had the strangling been real. Precious seconds passed. The sun was high and bright in a sky scalded free of clouds, and the grime of the alley clung like wet cement to the legs of Locke's breeches. Nearby, Jean Tannen lay in the same moist muck, while Galdo pretended, mostly, to kick his ribs in. He'd been merrily kicking away for at least a minute, just as long as his twin brother had supposedly been strangling Locke. Don Salvara was supposed to pass the mouth of the alley at any second, and, ideally, rush in to rescue Locke and Jean from their assailants. At this rate, he would end up rescuing them from boredom.
"Gods!" Carlo whispered, bending his mouth to Locke's ear, as though he might be hissing some demand. "Where the hell is that damn Salvara? And where's Bug? We can't keep this shit up all day. Other people do walk by the mouth of this damned alley." "Keep strangling me," Locke whispered. "Just think of 20,000 full crowns and keep strangling me. I can choke all day if I have to."
2. Everything had gone beautifully that morning in the run-up to the game itself, even allowing for the natural prickliness of a young thief finally allowed a part in his first big score.
"Of course I know where I'm supposed to be when the action starts," Bug whined. "I've spent more time perched up on that temple roof than I did in my mother's goddamned womb."
Jean Tannen let his right hand trail in the warm water of the canal while he took another bite of the sour marsh apple held in his left. The forward gunwale of the flat-bottomed barge was a choice spot for relaxation in the watered wine light of early morning, allowing all 16 stone of Jean's frame to sprawl comfortably, keg belly, heavy arms, bandy legs, and all. The only other person, and the one doing all the work, in the empty barge was Bug, a lanky, mop-headed 12-year-old braced against the steering pole at the stern.
"Your mother was in an understandable hurry to get rid of you, Bug."
Jean's voice was soft and even and wildly incongruous. He spoke like a teacher of music or a copier of scrolls.
"Where not? So indulge me once more with proof of your penetrating comprehension of our game."
"Damn it!"
Bug replied, giving the barge another push against the gentle current of the seaward-flowing canal.
"You and Locke and Carlo and Galdo are down in the alley between Fortunate Waters and the gardens of the Temple of Nara, right? I'm up on the roof of the temple across the way."
"Go on," Jean said around a mouthful of marsh apple. "Where's Don Salvara?"
Other barges, heavily laden with everything from ale casks to bleating cows, were slipping past the two of them on the clay-coloured water of the canal. Bug was poling them north along Camorra's main commercial waterway, the Via Camorrazza, toward the shifting market, and the city was lurching into life around them. The leaning grey tenements of water-slick stone were spitting their inhabitants out into the sunlight and the rising summer warmth. The month was Parthis, meaning that the night sweat of condensation already boiling off the buildings as a soupy mist would be greatly missed by the cloudless white heat of early afternoon.
He's coming out of the Temple of Fortunate Waters, like he does every Penance Day right around noon. He's got two horses and one man with him, if we're lucky.
A curious ritual, Jean said. Why would he do a thing like that?
Deathbed promise to his mother.
Bug drove his pole down into the canal, struggled against it for a moment, and managed to shove them along once more.
She kept the Vadran religion after she married the old Don Salvara, so he leaves an offering at the Vadran temple once a week and gets home as fast as he can so nobody pays too much attention to him. Damn it, Jean, I already know this shit. Why would I be here if you didn't trust me? And why am I the one who gets to push this stupid barge all the way to the market?
Oh, you can stop poling the barge any time you can beat me hand to hand, 3 falls out of 5. Jean grinned, showing 2 rows of crooked brawler's teeth in a face that looked as though someone had set it on an anvil and tried to pound it into a more pleasing shape. Besides, you're an apprentice in a proud trade, learning under the finest and most demanding masters it has to offer. Getting all the shit work is excellent for your moral education.
You haven't given me any bloody moral education.
Yes, well, that's probably because Locke and I have been dodging our own for most of our lives now. As for why we're going over the plan again, let me remind you that one good screw-up will make the fate of those poor bastards look sunny in comparison to what we'll get. Jean pointed at one of the city's slop wagons, halted on a canal-side boulevard to receive a long, dark stream of night soil from the upper window of a public alehouse. These wagons were crewed by petty criminals whose offences were too meagre to justify continual incarceration in the Palace of Patience. Shackled to their wagons and huddled in the alleged protection of long leather ponchos, they were let out each morning to enjoy what sun they could when they weren't cursing the dubious accuracy with which several thousand Camorri emptied their chamber pots.
"I won't screw it up, Jean."
Bug shook his thoughts like an empty coin purse, searching desperately for something to say that would make him sound as calm and assured as he imagined Jean and all the older gentleman bastards always were. But the mouth of most 12-year-olds far outpaces the mind.
"I just won't. I bloody won't. I promise."
"Good lad," Jean said. "Glad to hear it. But just what is it that you won't screw up?" Bug sighed.
"I make the signal when Salvara's on his way out of the Temple of Fortunate Waters. I keep an eye out for anyone else trying to walk past the alley, especially the city watch. If anybody tries it, I jump down from the temple roof with a long sword and cut their bloody heads off where they stand."
"You what?"
"I said I distract them any way I can. You going deaf, Jean?"
A line of tall counting houses slid past on their left, each displaying lacquered woodwork, silk awnings, marble facades, and other ostentatious touches along the waterfront. There were deep roots of money and power sunk into that row of 3- and 4-story buildings. Coin Kisser's Row was the oldest and goldest financial district on the continent. The place was as steeped in influence and elaborate rituals as the glass heights of the 5 towers, in which the Duke and the grand families sequestered themselves from the city they ruled. "Move us up against the bank just under the bridges, Bug." Jean gestured vaguely with his apple. "His nibs will be waiting to come aboard." 2 elder glass arches bridged the Via Camorazza right in the middle of Coin Kisser's Row, a high and narrow cat bridge for foot traffic and a lower, wider one for wagons. The seamless brilliance of the alien glass looked like nothing so much as liquid diamond, gently arched by giant hands and left to harden over the canal. On the right bank was the Fauna, a crowded island of multi-tiered stone apartments and rooftop gardens. Wooden wheels churned white against the stone embankment, drawing canal water up into a network of troughs and viaducts that crisscrossed over the Fauna's streets at every level. Bug slid the barge over to a rickety quay just beneath the cat bridge. From the faint and slender shadow of this arch, a man jumped down to the quay, dressed, as Bug and Jean were, in oil-stained leather breeches and a rough cotton shirt. His next nonchalant leap took him into the barge, which barely rocked at his arrival.
"Salutations to you, Master Jean Tannen, and profuse congratulations on the fortuitous timing of your arrival," said the newcomer.
"Ah, well, felicitations to you in respect of the superlative grace of your entry into our very humble boat, Master Lamora."
Jean punctuated this statement by popping the remains of his apple into his mouth, stem and all, and producing a wet crunching noise.
"Creeping shit, man!" Locke Lamora stuck out his tongue. "Must you do that? You know the black alchemists make fish poison from the seeds of those damned things."
"Lucky me," said Jean, after swallowing the last bit of masticated pulp, "not being a fish."
Locke was a medium man in every respect. Medium height, medium build, medium dark hair, cropped short above a face that was neither handsome nor memorable. He looked like a proper Therin, though perhaps a bit less olive and ruddy than Jean or Bug. In another light, he might have passed for a very tan Vadran. His bright grey eyes alone had any sense of distinction. He was a man the gods might have shaped deliberately to be overlooked. He settled down against the left-hand gunwale and crossed his legs.
"Hello to you as well, Bug. I knew we could count on you to take pity on your elders and let them rest in the sun while you do the hard work with the pole."
"Jean's a lazy old bastard is what it is," Bug said. "And if I don't pole the barge, he'll knock my teeth out the back of my head."
"Jean is the gentlest soul in Camor, and you wound him with your accusations," said Locke.
"Now he'll be up all night crying."
"I would have been up all night anyway," Jean added, "crying from the ache of rheumatism and lighting candles to ward off evil vapours."
"Which is not to say that our bones don't creak by day, my cruel apprentice." Locke massaged his kneecaps. "We're at least twice your age, which is prodigious for our profession."
"The daughters of Azaguia have tried to perform a corpse blessing on me 6 times this week," said Jean. "You're lucky Locke and I are still spry enough to take you with us when we run a game." To anyone beyond hearing range, Locke and Jean and Bug might have looked like the crew of a for-hire barge, slacking their way toward a cargo pickup at the junction of the Via Camarazza and the Angevin River. As Bug poled them closer and closer to the shifting market, the water was getting thicker with such barges, and with sleek black cockleshell boats and battered watercraft of every description, not all of them doing a good job of staying afloat or under control.
"Speaking of our game," said Locke, "how is our eager young apprentice's understanding of his place in the scheme of things?"
"I've been reciting it to Jean all morning," said Bug.
"And the conclusion is?"
"I've got it down cold."
Bug heaved at the pole with all of his strength, driving them between a pair of high-walled floating gardens, with inches to spare on either side. The scents of jasmine and oranges drifted down over them as their barge slipped beneath the protruding branches of one of the gardens. A wary attendant peeked over one garden boat's wall, staff in hand to fend them off if necessary. The big barges were probably hauling transplants to some noble's orchard upriver.
"Down cold, and I won't screw it up. I promise. I know my place, and I know the signals. I won't screw it up!"
3. Carlo was shaking Locke with real vigour, and Locke's performance as his victim was a virtuoso one, but still the moments dragged by. They were all trapped in their pantomime like figures out of the richly inventive hells of Therin theology. A pair of thieves destined to spend all eternity stuck in an alley, mugging victims that never passed out or gave up their money.
"Are you as alarmed as I am?"
Carlo whispered.
"Just stay in character," Locke hissed. "You can pray and strangle at the same time."
There was a high-pitched scream from their right, echoing across the cobbles and walls of the temple district. It was followed by shouts and the creaking tread of men in battle harness, but these sounds moved away from the mouth of the alley, not toward it.
"That sounds like Bug," said Locke.
"I hope he's just arranging a distraction," said Carlo, his grip on the rope momentarily slackening. At that instant, a dark shape darted across the gap of sky between the alley's high walls, its fluttering shadow briefly falling over them as it passed.
"Now what the hell was that, then?" Carlo asked.
Off to their right, someone screamed again. 4. Bug had pulled himself, Locke, and Jean from the Via Camorazza into the shifting market right on schedule, just as the vast elderglass wind chime atop West Watch was unlashed to catch the breeze blowing in from the sea and ring out the 11th hour of the morning. The shifting market was a lake of relatively placid water at the very heart of Camor, perhaps half a mile in circumference, protected from the rushing flow of the Angevine and the surrounding canals by a series of stone breakwaters. The only real current in the market was human-made, as hundreds upon hundreds of floating merchants slowly and warily followed one another counterclockwise in their boats, jostling for prized positions against the flat-topped breakwaters, which were crowded with buyers and sightseers on foot. City watchmen in their mustard-yellow tabards commanded sleek black cutters, each rowed by a dozen shackled prisoners from the Palace of Patience, using long poles and harsh language to maintain several rough channels through the drifting chaos of the market. Through these channels passed the pleasure barges of the nobility, and heavily laden freight barges, and empty ones like that containing the three gentlemen bastards, who shopped with their eyes as they sliced through a sea of hope and avarice. In just a few lengths of Bug's poling, they passed a family of trinket dealers in ill-kept brown cockle-shells, a spice merchant and his wares on a triangular rack in the middle of an awkward circular raft of the sort called a vertola, and a canal tree bobbing and swaying in the leather bladder pontoon raft that supported its roots. These roots trailed in the water, drinking up the piss and effluvia of the busy city. The canopy of rustling emerald leaves cast thousands of punctuated shadows down on the gentlemen bastards as they passed, along with the perfume of citrus. The tree, an alchemical hybrid that grew both limes and lemons, was tended by a middle-aged woman and three small children, who scuttled around in the branches, throwing down fruit in response to orders from passing boats. Above the watercraft of the shifting market rose a field of flags and pennants and billowing silk standards, all competing through gaudy colours and symbols to impress their messages on watchful buyers. There were flags adorned with the crude outlines of fish or fowl or both, flags adorned with ale mugs and wine bottles and loaves of bread, boots and trousers and threaded tailor's needles, fruits and kitchen instruments and carpenter's tools and 100 other goods and services. Here and there small clusters of chicken-flagged boats or shoe-flagged rafts were locked in close combat, their owners loudly proclaiming the superiority of their respective goods or inferring the bastardy of one another's children, while the watchboats stood off at a mindful distance, in case anyone should sink or commence a boarding action. "It's a pain sometimes, this pretending to be poor." Locke gazed around in reverie, the sort Bug would have been indulging in if the boy hadn't been concentrating on avoiding collision. A barge packed with dozens of yowling house-cats in wooden slat cages cut their wake, flagged with a blue pennant on which an artfully rendered dead mouse bled rich scarlet threads through a gaping hole in its throat. "There's just something about this place. I could almost convince myself that I really did have a pressing need for a pound of fish, some bowstrings, old shoes, and a new shovel."
"Fortunately for our credibility," said Jean, "we're coming up on the next major landmark on our way to a fat pile of Don Salvara's money."
He pointed past the northeastern breakwater of the market, beyond which a row of prosperous-looking waterfront inns and taverns stood between the market and the temple district.
"Right as always, Jean. Greed before imagination. Keep us on track,"
Locke added an enthusiastic but superfluous finger to the direction Jean was already pointing.
"Bug! Get us out onto the river, then veer right. One of the twins is going to be waiting for us at the tumble home, third in down on the south bank."
Bug pushed them north, straining to reach the bottom of the market's basin, which was easily half again as deep as the surrounding canals, with each thrust. They evaded overzealous purveyors of grapefruits and sausage rolls and alchemical light sticks, and Locke and Jean amused themselves with a favourite game, trying to spot the little pickpockets among the crowds on the breakwaters. The inattention of Camor's busy thousands still managed to feed the doddering old thief-maker in his dank warren under Shades Hill, nearly 20 years since Locke or Jean had last set foot inside the place. Once they escaped from the market and onto the river itself, Bug and Jean wordlessly switched places. The fast waters of the Angevine would be better matched against Jean's muscle, and Bug would need to rest his arms for his part in the game to come. As Bug collapsed in Jean's former place at the bow, Locke produced a cinnamon lemon, apparently from thin air, and tossed it to the boy. Bug ate it in 6 bites, dry skin and all, masticating the reddish-yellow pulp as grotesquely as possible between his bright, crooked teeth. He grinned.
"They don't make fish poison from those things, right?"
"No," Locke said. "They only make fish poison from things that Jean eats." Jean harumphed. "A little fish poison puts hair on your chest, excepting if you're a fish." Jean kept them nearly against the southern bank of the Angevine, clear of the depths where the pole couldn't reach. Shafts of hot pearl-white light flashed down on them as elderglass bridges passed directly between their barge and the still-rising sun. The river was 200 yards wide, sweating its wetness up into the air along with the smell of fish and silt. To the north, rippling under the heat haze, were the orderly slopes of the Alchigrante Islands, home to the city's greater commoners and minor nobles. It was a place of walled gardens, elaborate water sculptures, and white stone villas, well off limits to anyone dressed as Locke and Jean and Bug were. With the sun approaching its zenith, the vast shadows of the 5 towers had withdrawn into the upper city and were currently nothing more than a rosy stained glass glow that spilled just over the northern edges of the Alchigrante.
"Gods, I love this place," Locke said, drumming his fingers against his thighs. "Sometimes I think this whole city was put here simply because the gods must adore crime. Pickpockets rob the common folk, merchants rob anyone they can dupe. Kappa Barsavi robs the robbers and the common folk, the lesser nobles rob nearly everyone, and Duke Nicovante occasionally runs off with his army and robs the shit out of Tal Verar or Jerem, not to mention what he does to his own nobles and his common folk."
"So that makes us robbers of robbers," said Bug, "who pretend to be robbers working for a robber of other robbers. Yes, we do sort of screw the pretty picture up, don't we?"
Locke thought for a few seconds, clicking his tongue against the insides of his cheeks.
"Think of what we do as a sort of secret tax on nobles with more money than prudence. Hey, here we are."
Beneath the Tumbleholm Inn was a wide and well-kept quay with 6 mooring posts, none of them currently occupied. The smooth grey embankment was about 10 feet high here. Broad stone steps led up to street level, as did a cobbled ramp for cargo and horses. Carlo Sanza was waiting for them at the edge of the quay, dressed only slightly better than his fellows, with a gentled horse standing placidly behind him. Locke waved.
"What's the news?"
Locke cried. Jean's poling was skillful and graceful. The quay was 20 yards away, then 10, and then they were sliding up alongside it with a gentle scraping noise.
"Galdo got all the stuff packed into the room. It's the bowsprit suite on the 1st floor.
Carlo whispered in response, bending down to Locke and Bug as he picked up the barge's mooring rope. Carlo had dark liquor-coloured skin and hair, like an inky slice of night. The tautness of the flesh around his dark eyes was broken only by a fine network of laugh lines, though anyone who knew the Sanza twins would more readily describe them as smirk lines. An improbably sharp and hooked nose preceded his good looks like a dagger held at guard position. Once he had made the barge fast to a mooring post, Carlo tossed to Locke a heavy iron key attached to a long tassel of braided red and black silk. At a quality rooming house like the Tumble Home, each private suite's door was guarded by a clockwork lockbox, removable only by some cunning means known to the owners, that could be swapped out from a niche in the door. Each rented room received a random new box and its attendant key. With hundreds of such identical-looking boxes stored behind the polished counter in the reception hall, the inn could pretty much guarantee that copying keys for later break-ins was a practical waste of a thief's time. This courtesy would also give Locke and Jean guaranteed privacy for the rapid transformation that was about to take place. "Wonderful!" Locke leapt up onto the quay as spryly as he had entered the boat. Jean passed the steering pole back to Bug, then made the barge shudder with his own leap. "Let's go on in and fetch out our guests from Emberlane." As Locke and Jean padded up the steps toward the Tumble Home, Carlo motioned for Bug to give him a hand with the horse. The white-eyed creature was utterly without fear or personal initiative, but that same lack of self-preservation instincts might lead it to damage the barge very easily. After a few minutes of careful pushing and pulling, they had it positioned in the center of the barge, as calm as a statue that just happened to have lungs.
"Lovely creature," said Carlo. "I've named him Impediment. You could use him as a table or a flying buttress."
"Gentled animals, give me the bloody creeps."
"Whereas," said Carlo, "they give me the fucking creeps. But tenderfoots and softies prefer gentled pack horses, and that's our master merchant of Emberlane in a nutshell."
Several more minutes passed, and Carlo and Bug stood in amiable silence under the punishing sun, looking the part of an unremarkable barge crew waiting to receive a passenger of consequence from the bosom of the Tumble Home Inn. Soon enough, that passenger descended the stairs and coughed twice to get their attention. It was Locke, of course, but changed. His hair was slicked back with rose oil. The bones of his face seemed to shadow slightly deeper hollows in his cheeks, and his eyes were half concealed behind a pair of optics rimmed with black pearl and flashing silver in the sun. He was now dressed in a tightly buttoned black coat in the Emberlane style, almost form-fitted from his shoulders down to his ribs, then flaring out widely at the waist. Two black leather belts with polished silver buckles circled his stomach. Three ruffled layers of black silk cravats poured out of his collar and fluttered in the hot breeze. He wore embroidered grey hose over thick-heeled sharkskin shoes with black ribbon tongues that sprang somewhat ludicrously outward and hung over his feet with the drooping curl of hothouse flowers. Sweat was already beading on his forehead like little diamonds. Camor's summer did not reward the intrusion of fashions from a more northerly climate.
"My name," said Locke Lamora, "is Lucas Fairwhite."
The voice was clipped and precise, scrubbed of Locke's natural inflections. He layered the hint of a harsh Vajran accent atop a slight mangling of his native Camori dialect, like a barkeep mixing liquors.
"I am wearing clothes that will be full of sweat in several minutes. I am dumb enough to walk around Camor without a blade of any sort. Also," he said, with a hint of ponderous regret, "I am entirely fictional."
"I'm very sorry to hear that, Master Fairwhite," said Carlo, "but at least we've got your boat and your horse ready for your grand excursion."
Locke stepped carefully down toward the edge of the barge, swaying at the hips like a man newly off a ship and not yet used to surfaces that didn't tilt beneath his feet. His spine was arrow straight, his movements nearly prissy. He wore the mannerisms of Lucas Fairwhite like a set of invisible clothes.
"My attendant will be along any moment,"
Locke Fairwhite said, as they stepped aboard the barge.
"His name is Grauman, and he too suffers from a slight case of being imaginary."
"Merciful gods," said Carlo. "It must be catching."
Down the cobbled ramp came Jean, treading heavily under the weight of 120 pounds of creaking horses' harness, the embroidered leather packs crammed full of goods and strapped tightly shut. Jean now wore a white silk shirt, straining tight against his belly, and already translucent in places with sweat, under an open black vest and a white neckerchief. His hair was parted in the middle, and held in stasis by some thick black oil. Never picturesque, it now resembled two pads of wool arched over his forehead like a tenement roof.
"We're behind schedule, Grauman."
Locke clasped his hands behind his back.
"Do hurry up and let the poor horse do its job."
Jean heaved his mess over the gentled horse's back, to no visible reaction from the animal. He then bent down and fastened the harness securely under the horse's stomach. Bug passed the steering pole to Carlo, then slipped the barge's rope from the mooring post, and they were off once again.
"Wouldn't it be damned amusing," said Carlo, "if Don Salvara picked day to dodge out on his little ritual?"
"Don't worry," said Locke, briefly dropping the voice, if not the posture, of Lucas Fairwhite. "He's quite devoted to his mother's memory. A conscience can be as good as a water clock when it comes to keeping some appointments."
"From your lips to the gods' ears."
Carlo worked the pole with cheerful ease.
"And no skin off my balls if you're wrong. You're the one wearing a 10-pound black felt coat in the middle of Parthis."
They made headway up the Angevine and came abreast with the western edge of the temple district on their right, passing beneath a wide glass arch as they did so. Standing atop the middle of this bridge was a lean, dark-haired man with looks and a nose to match Carlo's. As Carlo poled the barge underneath the arch some 50 feet below, Galdo Sanza casually let a half-eaten red apple fall from his hands. The fruit hit the water with a quiet little splash, just a yard or two behind his brother.
"Salvara's at the temple," Bug said.
"Sublime." Locke spread his hands and grinned. "Didn't I tell you he suffered from an impeccable sense of maternal devotion?"
"I'm so pleased that you only choose victims of the highest moral quality," said Carlo. "The wrong sort might set a bad example for Bug."
At a public dock jutting from the northwestern shore of the temple district, just under the heights of the city's vast new house of Iono, father of storms, lord of the grasping waters, Jean tied them up in record time and led Impediment, looking every bit the part of a wealthy merchant's packhorse, up off the barge. Locke followed with Fairwhite's nervous dignity on full display. All the banter was now banked down like coals under a cook fire. Bug darted off into the crowds, eager to take up his watch position over the alley junction where Don Salvara's ambitions would soon be sorely tempted. Carlo spotted Galdo just stepping off the glass bridge and casually moved toward him. Both twins were unconsciously fingering the weapons concealed beneath their baggy shirts. By the time the Sanza brothers fell into step beside one another and began moving toward the rendezvous at the Temple of Fortunate Waters, Locke and Jean were already a block away, approaching from another direction. The game was afoot. For the fourth time in as many years, in quiet defiance of the most inviolate lore of Camor's underworld, the gentleman bastards were drawing a bead on one of the most powerful men in the city. They were headed for a meeting that might eventually divest Don Lorenzo Salvara of nearly half his worldly wealth. Now everything depended on the Don being punctual. 5. Bug was in a perfect position to spot the foot patrol before anyone else did, which was according to the plan. The foot patrol itself was also in the plan, after a fashion. It meant the plan was blown.
"You're going to be top eyes on this game, Bug," Locke had explained. "We're deliberately making first touch on Salvara on the most deserted street in the temple district. A spotter on the ground would be obvious a mile away, but a boy 2 stories up is another matter."
"What am I spotting for?"
"Whatever shows up. Duke Nicovante and the Nightglass Company, the King of the 7 Marrows, a little old lady with a dung wagon. If we get interlopers, you just make the signal. Maybe you can distract common folk. If it's the watch, well, we can either play innocent or run like hell."
and here were six men in mustard yellow tabards and well-oiled fighting harness, with batons and blades clattering ominously against their doubled waist belts, strolling up from the south just a few dozen paces away from the Temple of Fortunate Waters. Their path would take them right past the mouth of the all-important alley. Even if Bug warned the others in time for them to hide Carlo's rope, Locke and Jean would still be covered in mud, and the twins would still be, purposely, dressed like stage show bandits, complete with neckerchiefs over their faces. No chance to play innocent. If Bug gave the signal, it was run like hell time. Bug thought as fast as he ever had in his life, while his heart beat so rapidly it felt like someone was fluttering the pages of a book against the back of his lungs. He had to force himself to stay cool, stay observant, look for an opening. What was it Locke was always saying? Catalogue. He needed to catalogue his options. His options stank. 12 years old, crouched 20 feet up in the periphery of the wildly overgrown rooftop garden of a disused temple, with no long-range weapons and no other suitable distractions available. Don Salvara was still paying his respects to his mother's gods within the Temple of Fortunate Waters, and the only people in sight were his fellow gentleman bastards and the sweat-soaked patrol about to ruin their day. But 20 feet down and 6 feet to Bug's right, against the wall of the crumbling structure on which he squatted, there was a rubbish pile. It looked like mould-eaten burlap sacks and a mixed assortment of brown muck. The prudent thing to do would be to signal the others and let them scurry. Carlo and Galdo were old hands at playing hard to get with the yellow jackets, and they could just come back and restart the game again next week. Maybe. Or maybe a screwed-up game today would alarm someone and lead to more foot patrols in the coming weeks. Maybe word would get around that the temple district wasn't as quiet as it should be. Maybe Kappa Barsavi, beset by problems as he was, would take an interest in the unauthorized disturbance and turn his own screws. And then Don Salvara's money might as well be on the bloody moons, for all that the gentleman bastards could get their hands on it. No, prudence was out. Bug had to win. The presence of that rubbish pile made a great and glorious stupidity very possible. He was in the air before another thought crossed his mind. Arms out, falling backward, staring up into the hot near-noon sky with the confident assurance of all 12 of his years that death and injury were things reserved solely for people that weren't Bug. He screamed as he fell, in wild exultation, just to be sure that he had the foot patrol's unwavering attention. He could feel the great vast shadow of the ground looming up beneath him in the last half-second of his fall, and at that instant his eyes caught a dark shape cutting through the air just above the Temple of Fortunate Waters. A sleek and beautiful shape, heavy. A bird? A gull of some sort? Camor had no other birds that size. Certainly none that moved like crossbow bolts and... Impact with the semi-yielding surface of the rubbish heap walloped the air out of his lungs with a wet whoosh and snapped his head forward. Sharp chin bounced off slender chest, his teeth punched bloody holes in his tongue, and the warm taste of salt filled his mouth. He screamed again, reflexively, and spat blood. His view of the sky spun first left then right, as though the world were trying on strange new angles for his approval. Booted feet running on cobblestones, the creak and rattle of weapons in harness, a ruddy middle-aged face with two drooping sweat-slicked moustaches inserted itself between Bug and the sky.
"Perelandro's balls, boy!"
The watchman looked as bewildered as he did worried.
"What the hell were you doing screwing around up there? You're lucky you landed where you did!"
There were enthusiastic murmurs of agreement from the yellow-jacketed squad crowding in behind the first man. Bug could smell their sweat and their harness oil, as well as the rotten stench of the stuff that had broken his fall. Well, when you jumped into a street-side pile of brown glop in Camor, you knew going in that it wouldn't smell like rosewater. Bug shook his head to clear the white sparks dancing behind his eyes, and twitched his legs to be sure they would serve. Nothing appeared to be broken, thank the gods. He would re-evaluate his own claims on immortality when all of this was over.
Watch, Sergeant!
Bug hissed thickly, letting more blood spill out over his lips. Damn, his tongue burned with pain.
Watch, Sergeant!
Yes?
The man's eyes were going wider.
Can you move your arms and legs, boy? What can you feel?
Bug reached up with his hands, casually, not entirely feigning shakiness, and clutched at the watch sergeant's harness as though to steady himself.
Watch, Sergeant!
Bug said a few seconds later.
Your purse is much lighter than it should be. Out whoring last night, were we?
He shook the little leather pouch just under the watch sergeant's dark moustaches, and the larcenous part of his soul, which was, let us be honest, its majority, glowed warmly at the sheer befuddlement that blossomed in the man's eyes. For a split second, the pain of Bug's imperfect landing in the rubbish heap was forgotten. Then his other hand came up, as if by magic, and his orphan's twist hit the watch sergeant right between the eyes. An orphan's twist, or a little red keeper, was a weighted sack like a miniature cosh, kept hidden in clothes, but never against naked skin. It was traditionally packed full of ground shavings from a dozen of Camor's more popular hot peppers, and a few nasty cast-offs from certain black alchemists' shops. No use against a real threat, but just the thing for another street urchin, or a certain sort of adult with wandering hands. Or an unprotected face at spitting distance. Bug was already rolling to his left, so the spray of fine rust-coloured powder that erupted from his twist missed him by inches. The watch sergeant was not so lucky. It was a solid hit, scattering the hellish hot stuff up his nose, down his mouth, and straight into his eyes. He choked out a string of truly amazing wet bellows and fell backward, clawing at his cheeks. Bug was already up and moving with the giddy elasticity of youth. Even his bitterly aching tongue was temporarily forgotten in the all-consuming need to run like hell. Now he definitely had the foot patrol's undivided attention. They were shouting and leaping after him as his little feet pounded the cobbles and he sucked in deep, stinging gulps of humid air. He'd done his part to keep the game alive. It could now go on without him, while he gave the Duke's constables their afternoon exercise. A particularly fast-thinking watchman fumbled his whistle into his mouth and blew it raggedly while still running. Three short bursts, a pause, then three more. Watchman down. Oh, shit. That would bring every yellow jacket in half the city at a dead run, weapons out. That would bring crossbows. It was suddenly deadly important that Bug slip the squad at his heels before other squads started sending spotters up onto roofs. His anticipation of a merry chase vanished. He had perhaps a minute and a half to get to one of his usual cozy holes and pull a vanish. Suddenly, his tongue hurt very badly indeed. 6. Don Lorenzo Salvara stepped out of the temple portico into the stark, bright dampness of high Camori noon, little imagining the education a certain boy thief was receiving in the concept of too clever by half just across the district. The trilling of watch whistles sounded faintly. Salvara narrowed his eyes and peered with some curiosity at the distant figure of a lone city watchman, stumbling across the cobbles and occasionally bouncing off walls, clutching his head as though afraid it was going to float off his neck and up into the sky.
"Can you believe it, my lord?"
Conte had already brought the horses around from the temple's unobtrusive little stabling grotto.
"Drunk as a baby in a beer barrel, and not a heartbeat past noon. Fucking pissant lot of softies, these new golden rods."
Conte was a sun-wrinkled man of middle years, with the waistline of a professional dancer and the arms of a professional oarsman. The manner in which he served the young Don was obvious even without a glance at the pair of thigh-length stilettos hanging from his crossed leather belts.
"Hardly up to your old standards, eh?"
The Don, on the other hand, was a well-favoured young man of the classic Camori blood, black-haired, with skin like shadowed honey. His face was heavy and soft with curves, though his body was slender, and only his eyes gave any hint that he wasn't a polite young collegium undergraduate masquerading as a noble. Behind his fashionable rimless optics, the Don had eyes like an impatient archer, hungry for targets. Conte snorted.
In my day, at least we knew that getting shit-faced was an indoor hobby.
Conte passed the Don the reins of his mount, a sleek grey mare little bigger than a pony, well-trained but certainly not gentled. Just the thing for short trots around a city still more friendly to boats, or acrobats, as Doña Salvara often complained, than to horses. The stumbling watchman vanished around a distant corner, vaguely in the direction of the urgent whistling. As it seemed to be coming no closer, Salvara shrugged inwardly and led his horse out into the street. Here the day's second curiosity burst upon them in all of its glory. As the Don and his man turned to their right, they gained a full view of the high-walled alley beside the Temple of Fortunate Waters, and in this alley two finely dressed men were clearly getting their lives walloped out of them by a pair of bravos. Salvara froze and stared in wonder. Masked thugs in the temple district? Masked thugs strangling a man dressed all in black, in the tight, heavy, miserably inappropriate fashion of a Vardhan? And, merciful 12, a gentled pack-horse was simply standing there, taking it all in. After a handful of seconds lost to sheer amazement, the Don let his own horse's reins go and ran toward the mouth of the alley. He didn't need to glance sideways to know that Conte was barely astride behind him, knives out.
"You!"
The Don's voice was reasonably confident, though high with excitement.
"Unhand these men and stand clear!"
The closest footpad snapped his head around. His dark eyes widened above his improvised mask when he saw the Don and Conte approaching. The thug shifted his red-faced victim so that the man's body was between himself and the would-be interlopers.
"No need to trouble yourself with this business, my lord," the footpad said. "Just a bit of a disagreement. Private matter."
"Then perhaps you should have conducted it somewhere less public."
The footpad sounded quite exasperated.
"What? The Duke give you this alley to be your estate? Take another step, and I break this poor bastard's neck!"
"You just do that."
Don Salvara settled his hand suggestively on the pommel of his basket-hilted rapier.
"My man and I appear to command the only way out of this alley. I'm sure you'll still feel quite pleased at having killed that man when you've got 3 feet of steel in your throat."
The first footpad didn't release his hold on the coiled loops of rope that were holding up his barely conscious victim, but he began to back off warily toward the dead end, dragging the black-clad man clumsily with him.